the first question. Roses are red, violets are bluish. If it was not for Jesus, we would all be Jewish. Please comment. We still are. Jesus could not succeed. To be a Jewish has nothing to do with any race. It is an attitude. To be Jewish means to be calculating, to be under the world of law and not love. To be Jewish means not to be poetic, but to be arithmetical. To be Jewish means not to be in awe and the wonders that surrounds you. It is not just accidental that this whole century has been dominated by three Jews, Marx, Freud, and Einstein. Because the world is materialistic. And it has never been so materialistic as it is now. One Jew, Marx, invented the idea that life is nothing but economics. That's what I mean, the calculation. Even religion is economics. Even poetry is economics. Marx says, even consciousness depends on economical situations. It is a byproduct. Consciousness is a byproduct of economic situations, the structure of the society. Marx is the perfect Jew. You cannot find a better specimen than Freud, who tried to invent that the whole life moves according to unconscious laws, instincts. There is no conscious event in human life. Everything is dominated by the unconscious law. He was a fatalist. Fatalism is also an idea that the world is run by dead rules. To Marx, it is economics which rules everything. To Freud, it is unconscious instinct which rules everything. Then Einstein tried to invent that the whole life is nothing but a combination of atoms, all calculators. To be a Jew has nothing to do with the Jewish race. There are Jews who are Hindus. There are Jews who are Jains. There are Jews who are Buddhists. The Jew is an attitude. Christ has not succeeded. Christians are Jews. Because Christ can succeed only when La is defeated by love. When matter is defeated by spirit. When language is defeated by silence. When prose is defeated by poetry. When life is not ruled by economic, instinctive, historical laws, but life is ruled by grace, then Jesus succeeds. So don't think that you are not Jews. Out of 199% people are Jews. Only sometimes one person is not Jewish. That person lives a life of love. He has nothing to force his life to no pattern. He lives moment to moment. He flows from moment to another moment with no idea where he is going, with no goal. Then freedom happens. And only in freedom is consciousness. And only in freedom is God. God is total freedom. If you live moment to moment, not knowing where are you going, not knowing from where you are coming, if the past is irrelevant, and the future also, and only the present has any relevance, any reality, you go beyond being Jewish. Everybody is born a Jew. Rarely, very rarely, somebody dies and dies not as a Jew. That is a rare blessing. Just by calling yourself Christians, nothing is changed. Only labels change. The container changes, but the content remains the same. Jesus has failed. Not because his revolution was not worth succeeding. Jesus has failed because his revolution was too much for you. It was beyond you. Just to look that far away, that high, is impossible. Your eyes are fixed on the earth. You have completely forgotten the sky. And because you have forgotten the sky, you have forgotten that you have wings. Looking down, groping in the darkness of the earth, you have become creepers, like a snake. You are no more birds, birds of heaven. Jesus failed because you are so much deep in unconsciousness. And Jesus will go on failing. His very effort is such that success is almost impossible. As far as society is concerned, he may never succeed. Only with individuals the success is possible. Hence all those who have known, ask the awakened Buddha, Jesus, Krishna, Zarathustra, you will always find their insistence is on the individual. They know well that at the most you can expect few individuals to rise high. The greater humanity will do everything it can do to save its bondage, to remain secure in the imprisonment, to remain comfortable and live somehow dragging life as a burden and die somehow. The greater mass will not listen, will not understand, will not try to transform. Religion is individual, and religion has no names. Whenever somebody becomes religious, immediately he is no more a Hindu, a Mohammedan, a Christian. He is simply religious. It is an understanding. It is a different kind of knowing. A different way of seeing. And when you see differently, you see a different reality. The reality depends on your eyes. If your eyes change, the reality changes. If you are calculating, you will never be able to know more than matter, because calculation has its limitation. If you are too much arithmetical, you will never be able to know that which is beauty, that which is good, that which is true. You will never be able to know, because calculation cannot lead to that. How can you know a beautiful flower by being arithmetical? You can count the petals, but you will miss the beauty. You can count the parts, but you will miss the whole. And you are certain to miss the beauty which surrounds the flower, which exists like a climate around the flower, but cannot be got hold by counting the petals. You have to forget counting. You have to forget the mind that counts. The mind is you. Once you go beyond mind, you enter a different world. The world which cannot be accounted for, which cannot be explained, which is a mystery, and which remains a mystery. The deeper you go in it, the greater the mystery. The more you know, the less you know. And there comes a moment when you really know it, you know only one thing, that you don't know. The second question, I, Bhagavan, today I wanted to dance as you were speaking, and you even mentioned Kazantzakis, whom I love, but I feel inhibited to dance, though I was sitting in the back. The ashram feels conservative to me, but probably I didn't dance because of my own conservatism. Is this a question? Not at all. It is a confession. The ashram is not conservative, but you all are conservative, and you make the ashram. The ashram is not mine, it is yours. If it was mine, it won't be conservative. But I am alone and I cannot make the ashram. I am a stranger here. It consists of you. And you are conservative. The ashram becomes conservative. It cannot go beyond you. Because you are the constituent parts. It is the total of your conservatisms. But who bothers? If you are really in a state of dance, who bothers? Then you can dance even on the road. Maybe the police will come and take you to the prison, but that's okay. What can you do? If you can stop the dance, then it was not worth. It must have been a mind game. It must have been a just idea. An idea in the mind that you would like to dance, but not really. When dance happens, it is not an idea in the mind, not at all. It is a tremendous energy in the body. It has its own force. You are possessed. You cannot do anything. You forget the ashram, you forget the society, you forget the world. You are helpless, you are possessed by dance. Then something from the beyond enters. It must have been just an idea in the mind. That's why you stopped it. Ideas can be stopped, but when you are possessed, you cannot do anything about it. It happens, it is not done. And then it is divine when it happens. When you do it, it is human and ordinary. It is not a question, it is a confession. And you say that you love Kazantzakis. That too may be just an idea in the mind. Because people love things which they lack in their life. Reading Zorba the Greek, you may love Zorba. But if you meet Zorba, you may not like him. Because he will be such a totally different and altogether different being than you. Even Kazantzakis was never at ease with Zorba. They were friends. Zorba was a real person. He is not just a novel. Even Kazantzakis was very uneasy with him because he was a totally different type of man. Absolutely hedonist. Absolutely in the moment. Nothing else mattered than happiness. Of course, looks very selfish. Only sad people look unselfish. Happy people always look selfish. And happy people are always condemned because the whole society is unhappy. How you dare to be happy? And when everybody is so unhappy, you must be very selfish to be happy. Don't smile when everybody is weeping and crying. And don't laugh. Life is very miserable and it looks unmannerly. A man like Zorba will be will never be accepted in any home. You will not allow him to stay with you, because his very presence will be a disturbance. He does not believe in any morality. He knows only one morality of happiness. And I say to you that that is the only morality there is. All else is rubbish. Because only a happy person can be moral. Only a happy person is not interested in making others unhappy. Only a happy person creates an atmosphere around him where others can also be happy. But those others will not like the idea of your being happy when they are miserable. You may have loved Zorba, but you won't allow Zorba to become a guest in your home. He is unreliable. Such happy persons are dangerous. With sad, dead people, you can rely. They will not escape with your wife. Zorba can escape. He lives in the moment. He has no future, no past, no heaven, no hell. He is very true to the real moment. But you may have loved. This happens. This has to be understood. You always love the opposite. The opposite attracts you. But only in fantasy. In reality, it will be troublesome. People who have never loved, they go on reading poetries about love. Even sometimes they try to make poetries of love. This has been my observation. I have come across many poets. They have missed love in life, so they go on writing poetry about it. That's a substitute. Very pale, useless, but is still a little satisfying. At least something is there. Plastic flowers, but they look like flowers. Love is dangerous. To write poetry about love has no danger in it. Watch. If somebody is reciting a poetry on love, you may welcome him. But if that man really moves into love, then the society will condemn him. You read the story of Leela and Majnu, or Siri Farhad, and you will love it. But the people who were alive in the days of Majnu, they hated the man. Because who loves a lover? Try to be a lover and you will be condemned by the society. Write poetries about it. And maybe the president may give you an award. You may get a Nobel Prize. No lover ever gets a Nobel Prize. People who write poetry about love, they get Nobel Prizes. Man has become afraid of the real. But about the phony, there is no danger in it. Have you watched this? Sometimes you are sitting in your room or in your house and reading or doing something, and somebody knocks at the door. You feel very bad. Now somebody has come to disturb. You don't like even to answer. You would like to avoid. You send the servant to the door, you don't go yourself, or your child, to tell him that daddy is not at home. But if somebody gives you a call on the phone, then you are not disturbed. Then you immediately take the phone in the hand. Because the reality is so far away. Sometimes it has happened that a thief had entered in somebody's house and he was caught, and caught because of an old habit. The phone was ringing and he could not resist. He had to answer. A phone has to be answered. So he took the phone in the hand and he was caught. And when he was asked, "Why you bothered?" he said, "I completely forgot that I am a thief in the house. When phone rings, one has to answer." One man was doing some research work on this phenomena. He called 20 public phones and somebody or other answered. Then he inquired the man that, "Why you answered?" "Because it was not for you." He said, "I was just passing." "Then why you answered?" He said, "But the phone was ringing. It has a certain power. When the phone rings, you have to answer. It has a certain quality, something like hypnosis. You are not concerned, and it is certain that it is not ringing for you. It is a public phone. You are passing by the way. You are going to your office. Certain it is that it is not ringing for you. But why?" When the reality is far away, it is very easy to answer. When the reality comes nearer, it becomes more and more difficult. The greatest difficulties of life are concerned with the people who are very real to you and very near to you. The wife, the children, the husband. Very close, they are real. There is the trouble. You may have liked Zorba, even Kazantzakis liked the man when he was not with him. But when they lived together, it was really difficult, because sometimes he will come drunk and will start dancing and will dance the whole night. And he was a powerful man, very strong. When you live with such a man, it will be difficult. Unless you yourself are such a man. Don't create substitutes. That's a trick of the mind to deceive you. Love the real, don't love the phony. It is better to love than to write poetries on love. Because love will transform you. Love will give you insight. Love will give you insight into human heart, into your own and the others. Through love, there will be many unhappy moments, anguish, but there will be peaks of joy also. And that's how one grows. Through the night of anguish, then through the day of joy, one moves through the duality. It is a dialectical process. But just reading poetry about love is so convenient. Don't think that you really love. It is very easy, because nothing is at stake. Leo Tolstoy has written one of his memoirs, and he writes that when he was a small child, his mother used to go to the theater. They were very rich people. They belonged to the royal family. And in Moscow, the snow will be falling, a winter night. And the mother and the child will be in the theater. And Tolstoy remembers that whenever there was any tragedy, the mother will weep and cry and sob, and tears will flow down. And Tolstoy used to think that what deep compassion he has. But later on, by and by, he became aware that she has no compassion at all. This is a substitute. Then they will come out of the theater, and the driver sitting on the buggy and waiting for them will be dead, frozen in the ice. He could not leave the buggy. He had to be there. Any moment they will come. Frozen in ice, he will be dead. And the mother won't pay even a single attention to him. The man will be thrown out, thrown away. Another man should be called, and they will move, and she will not weep or cry. Tolstoy says, then I became aware that that compassion was phony. That was a trick. It is very easy to cry in the theater because nothing is involved. Very easy to cry looking at a movie. Everybody cries. But to cry in life will be difficult because then something is involved. If you cry for this man who is dead, your driver, then next time you will have to change your style of life. Then if it is snowing too much, you will not go to the theater. Or you will make arrangements for the driver to sit somewhere. Or you will make arrangements for better clothing. But that will affect your style of life. Who bothers for the real man? People cry when they read novels, when they see a movie, when they go to the theater. But in real life, their eyes simply are vacant, empty. No tears come. Remember this. If you really love Zorba, you will become a Zorba. If you love Jesus, you will become Jesus. This is one of the fundamental laws of life. That if you love somebody, if you love something, by and by, the object of your love transforms you and you become alike. Have you observed? Sometimes you come across a couple, wife and husband, who look alike. They talk in the same way. They walk in the same way. They smile in the same way. A deep affinity. What has happened? Because they are not brother sisters. Why they are so alike? They loved each other. And they loved deeply. When you love somebody, you are vulnerable. Then the other changes you. And you go on changing the other. Wife and husbands, if they really love each other, by the time life comes to end, they will be almost alike. It has to be so. Love transforms. But theater and the movie and the novel and the poetry, they will not transform you much. In fact, they are the ways how to avoid the transformation. They are the ways how not to look at life and live in fantasy. This is not a question, this is a confession. If you really wanted to dance, who can prevent you? And when that type of dance happens, who would like to prevent you? When you are possessed and it is not a mind thing. Next time you are possessed, don't be worried about the ashram. Let them do whatever they want to do. That is not your business to be worried. Dance. But remember, this should not be a mind thing. Otherwise, you will create simply a disturbance. Be possessed. When you are possessed, the dance is holy. Third question, you said, if there were no reformers, then the world would be a more natural and beautiful place. Then why is your ashram so full of reformers? To reform the reformers. The world is full of reformers. What to do? They have to be reformed. I am training people who can reform the reformers. The question is not signed. The person who has asked this must be afraid. You should not be afraid. You should sign your question. So I exactly know in whose mind this question is arising. Because I don't ask the question, I don't answer the question, I answer the questioner. The question is useless if you are so afraid even to sign it. If you don't want to reveal your identity, your whole heart is not in the question. Why do you try to deceive? Even if the question is foolish, you have to show your identity. Because here you are not to hide yourself. Here you are to expose yourself. Expose to me so that I can change you. If you go on hiding, then how can I change you? If you are foolish, it's okay. Be foolish. But let it be exposed. If you are dark, don't be afraid. Open the doors. Otherwise, from where the light will enter? Here there is not going any argument or discussion. I am not interested in any discussion or any argument. If I say something to you, I say it not as an argument. Not for any argument's sake. I'm not trying to defend any dogma, any religion, any scripture. I have none. No dogma, no scripture, no religion to defend. I'm trying to create a communion between you and me. But if you are hiding, you will miss. Reveal always your identity. And don't try to polish the question. Because that too I feel. You make the question. You polish it. You try to make it in such a way that it looks very sophisticated. Very cultured. The more you polish it, the further away it is from your reality. Let it be raw, so that it is close to your heart. If your question itself has gone very far away from your heart, then how my answer is going to be close to you? My answer will hit the question, and you will be very far away from it. Let it be raw like a wound, so I can hit it directly. It will hurt. That's why you try to push it away from you. But if you are so much afraid of being hurt, then the surgery that I am trying to do will not be possible. It is a surgery. You have a very ill mind, a cancerous growth in the mind. It has to be operated upon. It will hurt, certainly it will hurt. But that hurt is beneficial, because once it hurts and the growth is removed, you will be healthy and whole. So don't try to hide. Be true. Now remember, you can move to the other extreme. You can try to look very raw. That won't help. You just be yourself. The fourth question. While at one place, Christ asks his disciples to carry their cross every day. At another, he bids them to celebrate his presence as that of a bridegroom. Why this contradiction? There is none. It appears. Every moment, one has to remember death, because any moment it is possible. That is the meaning to carry the cross every day. You should not forget death. Once you forget death, you relapse into unconsciousness. If you remember death, you remain alert, awake. But when we say remember death, we don't mean that you become oppressed by the idea, obsessed by the idea. We don't mean that you create a deep fear about death and tremble continuously. That will be morbidity. That will be perversion. There are two types of perverted people in relationship with death. One, those who have completely forgotten or try to forget that death is. They try to avoid. They would not like even to talk about death. If you start talking with them about death, they will think you uncivilized, unmannerly. They will avoid the very topic. They will not go to the cemetery. That's why cemeteries are built out of the town, so nobody comes accidentally across. Only when one has to come, then. Otherwise you can avoid. Death is a taboo subject. More tabooed than sex. Nobody talks about it. And everybody knows it is coming. A great deception humanity lives in. This is one morbidity. But then there is another morbidity. You can move to the other extreme. And you can become obsessed with death. And you can constantly tremble. And you cannot sleep in the night, because who knows, you may not get up in the morning. And you cannot eat well, because how can you eat when death is coming? And you cannot love, because how can you love anybody when everybody is going to die? That too is morbid. That too is perversion. Jesus says, carry your cross every day. He says, remember death and still let every moment be a celebration of life. Death is coming. That is all the more a deeper reason to celebrate. Because who knows, this may be the last moment. This moment of life is not to be disturbed by the fear of death, but against death, in contrast to death, this moment has to be celebrated even more deeply, because who knows, next moment we may not be here. And while the bridegroom is here, celebrate it. The parable of the bridegroom can become a very inner thing. Within you, the body is the body of death, and your consciousness is life, the source of life. You are both. Your body is going to die. It belongs to the earth, dust unto dust. It will have to go. It will return to its source. You belong to the sky. You belong to God. Your consciousness is separate from your body. This is the meaning of Jesus on the cross. Everybody is on the cross, because consciousness lives in the body, and the body is death. If you understand, everybody is on the cross. But that should not become a pessimism. On the contrary, that should be all the more cause to celebrate. The bridegroom is within you, and the body is the chamber of the bridegroom. Celebrate it. Jesus is not contradictory. Jesus is simply plain. The contradiction is in life itself, that life exists through death, and death exists through life. Life itself is the paradox. But that is the beauty also. All beauty exists in contrast. And all life exists as a tension between opposites. It is a bridge built on two banks, death and life. Celebrate every moment, because this may be the last moment. But while celebrating, don't forget that death is coming. That death comes. Remember. Remembrance should not become an obsession. Remembrance should become a celebration. Carry the cross, but carry it dancing. Carry the cross, but carry it singing. Carry the cross, but carry it with a deep celebration within. Then you live both. You live life, you live death, and you live both deeply and intensely. And when you can live both intensely, they become one. Then you know life and death are two aspects of the same thing, of the same energy. Life is expression, manifestation. Death is a returning. The sixth question: would you define and discuss the nature of consciousness? How does consciousness relate to ego? Is consciousness the creative principle? That is, could you say equally, in the beginning was consciousness, as in the beginning was the word or the logos? How does consciousness relate to God? In the beginning was the word or the logos. The same cannot be said about consciousness. Because in the beginning, the unconsciousness was also there. Consciousness is just a part of your reality, the reality of the within. Unconsciousness is also there. So just consciousness was not in the beginning. Unconsciousness was also there as much as consciousness. Or you can say something was there in the beginning in which consciousness and unconsciousness both are involved. That is the meaning of God. God is not only consciousness. God is consciousness plus unconsciousness. God is dark night and the bright day both. Summer and winter both. Life and death both. God is the beginning and the end both. God is beyond duality. And the duality is intrinsic in Him. He is both matter and mind. The manifest and the unmanifest. Consciousness is just a part of great oceanic unconsciousness. Consciousness is just on the surface. Deep hidden are layers and layers of unconsciousness. One has to transcend both to know that which was in the beginning, which is God. Would you define and discuss the nature of consciousness? How does consciousness relate to ego? One part of you is conscious. 1/10. 9/10 of you is unconscious. If the conscious part thinks itself as the whole, it becomes the ego. Then it forgets about the unconscious. Then the part imagines itself as the whole. Then it is the ego. If the conscious becomes aware of the unconscious also, that is the whole effort of religion. That is the whole effort of meditation. If the conscious turns back, looks back, and becomes aware of the unconscious also, the dark night within. And then the conscious knows that I am conscious, I am unconscious also. And my consciousness is just a wave on the ocean. And unconscious is vast. Then the ego disappears. Ego is the part thinking itself as the whole. Non-ego is the part becoming aware of the whole. Then the ego disappears. And how to define the nature of consciousness? Never it has been defined. Never will it be defined. Because who will define it? To define it, you have to be away from it. To define anything, you have to stand out of it. You need a distance. The perspective will not be possible if the distance is not there. You are consciousness. You are unconsciousness. There is nobody who can stand out and define. You can know it, but you cannot define it. That's why all religion is mysterious, mystic, vague, cloudy. Because no term which is very basic to religion can be defined. The subject cannot be made an object. I cannot put myself in front of me. So I cannot define. Neither Buddha has defined, nor Jesus. Definition as such is debarred by the very nature of the phenomenon. Everything else can be defined because the consciousness is the definer. Everything else is before consciousness. The consciousness can know, go around, watch, observe, experiment, define, dissect. But who will define consciousness? You cannot go further away from it. You are it. You can know it. But you cannot define it. Knowledge is not possible, only knowing. I can help you to create a meditative state where you can know what it is. I can give you the method, but I cannot give you the definition. That's why religion always looks a little suspicious. Why don't you define your terms? Just do as science does. Define. If you cannot define your terms, that simply shows you don't know what you are talking about. A great linguist and a positivist philosopher, A.J. Ayer, he says that if we take two terms, God and dog, then the second is true and the first is false. Because nobody can define God. The word is meaningless. God cannot be defined. Dog can be defined. Dog is more meaningful than God. If you insist for definition, then only things can be defined. Persons cannot be defined. Laws can be defined. Love cannot be defined. Gravitation can be defined, but grace cannot be defined. That which is without is definable. That which is within is elusive. One has to understand it and move into meditations. Buddha says that Buddhas can only show you the way. You have to move. One day you come upon the goal. Nobody can give you the goal beforehand. Not even a definition is possible. And it is good that a definition is not possible. Otherwise, you will settle with the definition, you will settle with the information, and you will never travel. You will never journey to the goal. And sometimes it happens that the very map that you were thinking to use for the journey becomes the barrier. Then you are satisfied with the map. I was reading one very rare autobiography of a man who belonged to a very primitive race in the Amazons. He was the son of the chief, and his father was a great lover of the river Amazon. And his father has moved to the very source of the river. And then this boy, the son of the chief, went to America. Some missionaries helped him to study. He studied there, became a graduate, came back home, thinking that my father loves Amazon so much, he would be very happy if I bring him the map, the detailed map of the Amazon. So he purchased the best map available and brought it to his father. He was thinking that he will be very happy, but he looked at the map and he was very sad. And he threw the map away. The son was very much hurt. I have brought a gift, a present, and my father has thrown away. Why? He asked the father. He said, "This is absolutely bogus, because I don't see the Amazon anywhere. And how the Amazon can exist on the paper? You are a fool and you are deceiving me. And I have moved with Amazon. And I know what it is. And don't be deceived by this map. Only lines are there." Definitions of God are maps, lines on paper. Definitions of consciousness are maps. And sometimes people get too much obsessed with maps. The best way to be lost is to have a map. You cannot fail. If you have a real detailed map, you will be lost in it. And the mind will think that now I know everything. The living Amazon is a beauty, dangerous, terrible. At any moment, life is at stake. With the map, conveniently sitting in your easy chair, you can study it and you can know all about the Amazon. But in the world outside you, maps have a little relevance, but in the inside world, they are absolutely irrelevant. If you have any maps, throw them away. And all the religions have given you maps. Throw them away. Enough of the maps. Now let there be a real journey. And when you will attain to your consciousness, then you will laugh at the stupidity of the map makers. Then you will know that they have never been to the innermost source of life. They have been copying from other map makers. And for centuries they go on copying. And they go on adding their own fantasy and their own ideas. And they go on changing and decorating. And all maps are false, because the innermost remains indefinable. But there is no need to define. Consciousness is there within you. Return, and the kingdom of God is at hand. Why be bothered by the definition, when the thing, the real thing, is so close? Why not taste it? When the river is flowing, you ask me about the definition of water, and I know you are thirsty. And I know that the definition cannot quench the thirst. But you say, unless water is defined, how can I drink the water? But I can't see the point. If people had waited just for the definition, only then they will quench their thirst. Humanity would have disappeared long before. Because water is still indefinable. Don't be befooled what scientists say. They may be saying that water is H2O. Two parts hydrogen, one part oxygen. But when the scientist is thirsty, give him oxygen and hydrogen to drink. Then you will know. That he will say, what are you doing? Have you gone mad? Water quenches thirst, not two parts of hydrogen and one part of oxygen. Mullah Nasruddin's son came back from the university. And he was studying logic there, and he has become a great philosopher. As in youth, everybody is prone to. Youth is foolish, and to become a philosopher is easy. And he was very much interested in sowing his knowledge, fresh from the university, everybody is. They were sitting on the dining table. And the mother has brought two apples. Seeing an opportunity, the son of Mullah Nasruddin said, Mummy, I will show you something which I have learned. What do you see on this plate? The mother said, two apples. He said, no. Logic says something else. There are three apples, not two. The poor mother looked again, but there were two apples. She said, what do you mean? He said, look, watch. This apple is one. This apple is two. How many are one plus two? The mother said, of course, one plus two is three. The son was very happy. Mullah Nasruddin was watching. He said, good, very good. So I will eat the one and your mother will eat the two. You eat the third. But you cannot eat logic, you cannot eat science, you cannot eat philosophy. And religion is concerned to quench your thirst. Religion is concerned with your hunger, not with definitions, maps. The seventh question, you said, we are not doing anything here, but we who live and work here in the ashram are continuously occupied with doing. In fact, the more we do, the more we are praised, and anyone who does not or does less is scolded. Please explain. When I said we are not doing anything here, I meant I am not doing anything here. Because I love you. When you love, the doing is not doing at all. If you love me, then you will also not think that you are doing very much. In fact, you will not think that you are doing anything. Love is not a duty. In love, work becomes worship. And you work in the ashram, the whole quality of work and the attitude will be different if you love me. If you don't love me, Of course, it is work. And then your mind will hanker for praise. Then, in many ways, you will try to avoid the work, as many of you are doing. You go on finding ways and means how to avoid it, how not to do. I never avoid because I love you. And the more I can do, the better I feel. But you avoid as if work is something that you are dragging, a burden. If work is a burden, then only it looks like work. If work is out of love, it becomes worship. And then there is no need for any other meditation. It is enough. It itself becomes the meditation. You are so deeply in it that the mind stops. And the energy needs work. Otherwise, the energy will become restlessness. The energy needs expression. And the energy needs to be creative. Otherwise, the same energy coiled upon within you will become disease and illness. You have energy. The energy has to be creative. And there is no happiness except in creativity. But creativity is work with love. A painter paints. He is not working. He is loving. He is completely absorbed in it. The doer is not there. A singer sings or a dancer dances. If the dancer is just a professional, then it is work. Then he will be tired. But if a dancer really loves dancing, then the more he moves into it, the more energy he gets to move further on. It is said about one of the greatest dancers that has ever walked on earth, Nijinsky. It is said about him that even scientists were surprised. They couldn't believe his jump. When he will dance, he will take such big jumps which are against gravitation. They are not possible. You cannot jump that much. And the way he will jump, so gracefully, and when he will be coming down, he will come like a dove, so slowly, as if the gravitation is not functioning. Many times Nijinsky was asked, "What is the secret?" He said, "I don't know. Except that I love dancing." And once he said, "When you love dancing, then you don't function under the law of gravitation. You function under the law of grace." That is the difference between Moses and Jesus. Moses brings the law of gravitation into the world. All those 10 commandments are laws, just like gravitation. Jesus brings the law of grace, which is not a law at all. When you love deeply, you function in a totally different dimension. This question would not have arisen. You would not think it as work. Watch a mother, how much she does for the child. But if you ask her, she will say, "I have not been doing anything. In fact, many more things were needed to be done and I have not done. And I always feel that my child has not received as much care as was needed. Then go to a secretary of a club or an institute and ask him. He will give you a long list that he has been doing there. He will include even things which he has not done. They will be included in the list. He is a doer. A mother is a lover. I was reading the biography of a Hindu sannyasin who lived in South Africa. He came for a pilgrimage to the Himalayas. He was going uphill and it was hot and he was perspiring and gasping for breath. The journey was hard. And just in front of him was a girl, not more than 10 years of age, carrying a child, very heavy and fat, on her shoulders, perspiring. The sannyasin talked to the girl and said, "My daughter, the child seems to be very heavy." The girl looked at the sannyasin and said, "Swamiji, he is not a burden, he is my brother. He is not a burden at all. He has no weight, he is my brother." When you love, weight disappears. When you love, you function in a different world. The last question, is this it? Am I experiencing you? Has the final journey begun? This is from Dharmatirtha Bodhisattva. Yes. Enough for today.